Boker Tov world. Today's daf in Masechet Chumin, brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, is daf Kuf Yud Beit, and right at the top of the daf. Now, yesterday we discovered a completely new world in what is called Nat Bar Nat, and this is a reference to very specific cases. First of all, the entire discussion of Nat Bar Nat is in terms of taste that is a ben yomo. If it's not ben yomo, then remember the taste is really irrelevant anyway, because it's only actually a pagam. That's called notin ta'am lifgam. So first of all, we have to be talking about a ta'am. The ta'am would be if it's a ben yomo. Then the question is, if the ta'am was absorbed into a pot, now, the din of Nat Bar Nat does not apply to cases where it was absorbed by a foodstuff. If it's absorbed directly by a foodstuff, then it's considered to be a full ta'am. It's where a pot, a kli of some kind, absorbs a taste. And that is not considered to be a complete true taste. It's a bar notin ta'am. So it's basically one level removed from the original source, which was the notin ta'am, and any taste that comes out of that pot is considered the child of what was originally just a notin ta'am. And that's called notin ta'am bar notin ta'am. Now, there's a lot of machlokas in about precisely at what stage something is called a notin ta'am bar notin ta'am. But let's understand that we're only talking about, and this is an important concept, we're only talking about notin ta'am bar notin ta'am, the hetera. The hetera means that at the time that this ta'am was actually came out as the notin ta'am bar notin ta'am, it was hetera. That does not mean that it was a tera at the time that it was absorbed. Because let's say you would have a meat pot. Meat because you cooked meat in it. So now we call that a meaty pot, fleshing a pot, a kli bisari. And you cooked milk in that pot. That's not called notin ta'am bar notin ta'am the hetera. We don't say that since the taste that went into the pot was only a notin ta'am, and then the notin ta'am that's put back into the milk is only the child of that notin ta'am. That's called notin ta'am bar notin ta'am the isura, not the hetera. It has to be the hetera when it comes out as the secondary notin ta'am, as the nat bar nat. If as it comes out, it is coming out into the isur, the state of isur, basar v'cholam, we don't view it as not bar not the hetera. And those were the essential things that we discovered yesterday. And we also discovered another very important idea, which is called agav churfei de sakina. Agav churfei de sakina is based on a very profound physical principle. And it's something that people ignore unless they're old enough to have been playing phonograph records once upon a time. So agav churfei de sakina means that when you have a thin surface, such as a little tiny diamond phonograph needle, which is just thousandths of millimeter in size at the point, the amount of pressure that it is under, if even the slightest weight is on it, is immense. So let's say if you put 1 pound of pressure on something that is just that small, the actual pressure that it's under is tens of thousands of pounds per square inch, which is immense, which is why those phonograph needles used to get completely wiped out in very little time, even if they were made of diamond. And so, the idea over here is a knife has a sharp edge, and it's under immense pressure. When you take that knife, you cut something, you don't think you're putting on much pressure because you're only putting on, let's say, 20, 30 pounds of pressure on the handle of the knife if you're cutting and pressing hard. But that means you're putting tens of thousands of tons of pressure on the tip of the knife. Now, you need to understand that that type of pressure is going to press out anything that has been absorbed, and remember that absorption takes place essentially because of the fact that molecular surfaces are attracted to other molecular surfaces. It's not something that you can see. It's something that actually, to you, it looks like the knife has a solid surface. But to a molecule, it looks like there's just nothing but space between the atoms, right? So there's tons of space for the molecules of the atom to be absorbed. When you put the kind of pressure that you put on the tip of the knife, you're doing something that is immensely changing of the interrelationship of the crystalline structure of the metal. And because of that, it actually will put a taste into the thing that you are pressing. It's very important to understand how real this is. That's called Durka de Sakina. The other issue that we discovered yesterday was the concept called Agav Churpe. Agav Churpe means when something has a sharp taste. There's two issues about sharp tastes. Number one, sharp, such a shame that people don't come on time and end up just behind on such a sadistic of things. Okay. In any event, the meaning, there's two very important meanings of things that have sharp tastes. First of all, it negates the effect of eno ben yoma. It negates the effect of no tain tam lif gam, because something that is exceedingly sharp actually hides the pigam of something and allows whatever usable taste is left to actually come out and to be a tam, of that would be iser. And Mr. Gavi has just missed a very important review of essential Gavi Yesodot, and he has to start coming on time or double his boost, which will get him up earlier. Maybe start at midnight or something. So, we've been discussing yesterday's Gavi's ideas, and we're now currently talking about the impact of the nature of Harifut. So, first of all, it negates the Noisin Tam Livgam, but secondly, it also pulls off, like you would use things that are sharp in your kitchen cleaners to be able to attract things that are maybe stuck to your counter, tastes that are stuck to your counter. A dover chorif has the reason that it's chorif is because it does this, you see. The point is that your tongue detects the charifas of things because of the fact that they have that particular type of attraction, molecular attraction. It could be that it's because of acid. It could be it's because of base. It could be because it's a surfactant. There's many reasons, but your tongue will taste it in all cases. It will taste as a davar charif in different ways. So because of that, and remember, those are your four basic tastes, are really very, very simple molecular detectors. It's your nose that does the eager job of things that taste like things to you. And therefore, these ideas are really very simple physical realities. So, putting all of those things together yesterday, we came up with situations where not by not will not only take place in terms of the absorption of a metal, that or a cheres or some type of material which has absorption capabilities, as opposed to things that don't have holes between their molecules, such as glass. The whole point of glass is that it's essentially a flowing surface, even though to you it appears to be stuck in one place. For all intents and purposes, that's what makes it glassy, is that it doesn't have these holes. And because of that, there's no absorption in it. But we were talking about zchuchit, or we're talking about cheres, or we were talking about metal. Those type of things look to a molecule like they're full of holes. And because of that, we've got a lot of taste in it. So specifically in such a situation where we're talking about a penetration of a taste into non-foodstuffs, and it's bound to a metal, or it's bound to some other kind of surface that's not edible. Over there, there's a reduction in the tam, and that's the first notein tam. And when that tam comes out into something else, that is a no tintam, bar no tintam. And if that something else does not involve iser, so it's not as if a taste of meat came out into milk, it's a taste of meat came out into a piece of fish, which was the case that we talked about yesterday, the classic case in the Gemara. So then we have that problem of not bar not, and if it's hetera at the time that it came out, so then we say that the fish, according to Shmuel, could be eaten together with things that are milchig. So we talked about kutach, which is made out of, it's like a sour milk dip. But, continues the Gemara today, after the last words, agav churpe bola, that something that is not bolea because it does not present that type of surface to the knife. You're cutting something like a squash. Well, the reason that squashes are called squashes is because they're squishy, and that's no coincidence. And since it's squishy, you actually do not have the whole problem of this duchke de sakina and so on. All you need to do is gorer leve piske the ochel. The point over there is that there may be shamnunit de isura on the surface of a knife, and that's because the same idea of duchke de sakina, which allows the molecular structure that had was actually attracting something that was an iser achila to add the additional pressure will actually put things out of the knife, but there's also the surface of the knife. And the surface of the knife, because of the fact that when it cuts initially, it also cuts even in terms of the surface, there's a very tight bind between the whatever it is that you cut, a fat, let's say, that you cut, and the metal, even the visible metal of the knife, so that you may have one molecule thick layer of fat on the knife that you will not notice at all. And it will look to you like it's completely clean because it does not register to your senses. Nonetheless, that's called shamnunis, that is be'in. It's an actual layer of shamnunit on the top of a knife. The only way to get rid of that is to pay attention to it. So you'd have to actually rub it down or put it through a dishwasher and hot water and so on. And then you can have a clean knife. But normally, even though other things are considered to be clean, when they're cleaned after eating, a knife is not considered to be clean because of the fact that it only looks clean. And in order for a knife to be clean, you had to sharpen that knife or put it through a dishwasher or use a very rough surface cloth on it, and then it would be clean. Otherwise, we assume that knives are dirty, and it's as if you have a ben on the socket. Therefore, even though when you squash a squishy squash, you're actually not doing anything with exuding things from the knife, but what about the surface shamnunit, which does actually get onto the squash? Now, normally, what would happen in such cases, you would just wash it off. However, you can't wash off a squash. Why don't you try it at home, and you will soon discover why you can't wash off a squash that you just cut. But what you can do is you could actually scrape the area that was in touch with the knife. Now, you don't have to make a klipa. And the difference between klipa and gerira is that a klipa has to be a thin actual piece that you can hold together. It can be absolutely thin enough to look through, but it has to hold together. But if you do gerira and you're just scraping off, you do not have to have an actual piece. As long as you rub off the top layer, that would be fine on a squash. So that's gorele. You gorele bepaske, the part that had come in touch with the knife, you're gorer. So we've spoken about kidei klipa, kidei nitila, grira, and hadacha. We've had four different issues of what to do in cases where you have a surface contact with some tam that you need to get off. Now let's take another example. If you're not talking about a squash, you could be talking about something that actually you do cut through and it's not squishy, like the stalk of a turnip. So kilchei belifta, however, they are also different because they have a very powerful taste. And that's not called a sharp taste because they aren't sharp. It's called halachically a sweet taste. So it's a mitikut, even though I don't know people would call turnip sweet in English. But in terms of the halacha, it's the opposite of something which is sharp. And so because of that, it overwhelms whatever little bit of fat that may have been on the surface of the knife. And therefore, you don't even have to rinse it according to the way most understand the inyanim of Rashi. Now, not everybody agrees with that, and we don't paskin like that. We paskin that you do at least need to be rinsed, but you don't need to be gorir. You don't have to scrape anything off. You can simply rinse it, but rinsing wasn't an option for a squishy squash. Now, how about cutting something like beet stalks? Beet stalks are considered to be sharp, and therefore they become osir the same way that the radish is osir. Now, if you switch cutting, and first you cut the beet, and then you cut the turnip, so then if you interchange them, so between every piece of isser you had turnip, that would be fine, because then we consider the turnip to wash off the knife before you got to the beet. Would it be mut? All I want to do is put a container of salt, an open container of salt, next to an open container of kutach in my pantry. Now the question is whether it's necessary to worry that some of the kutach, because of the fact you take this thing in and out, bring it to the table, take a little bit of the kutach, put it into a serving thing, and which you can actually put it, dip your bread in it, which is the way that it's eaten. And so it tends to spatter a little bit on the surface. It would be like having a container of hummus, which looks nice until you start dipping stuff into it. So you have your container of kutach. Can you put it next to a container of salt, or do you need to worry that maybe some of the kutach might actually slip into the salt, which you wouldn't notice, and then you might use that salt on meat? And Reb Nachman said, you do have to worry about that, and asur, you can't put the two of them next to each other. Now, fascinatingly, we saw before, you could certainly put a jar of milk next to meat. I mean, that seems a heck of a lot more serious than putting the possible mixture in the salt, but the point is that that's exactly the issue. Where you're dealing with meat and milk, you are careful because you're always aware of not mixing milk and meat. But where you're talking about salt and hummus, in this case it's a milk and hummus because it's a milk dip, you don't have that sense of, oh gosh, I got to keep these two things apart. And therefore, it is likely, said Reb Nachman, that you're going to get a little bit of kutach in the salt. Ask Reb Dimi, okay, how about not salt? How about a jar of vinegar? Amalei, that's butter. Said Reb Dimi, what's the difference? I mean, it's the same problem. The vinegar is used to cauterize the meat, and so on. So Reb Nachman always used to joke around when people asked him things that were very obvious, and he went, in this case, it was his primary joke, because he was talking about the difference between salt and vinegar. But he uses this as an expression all the time. And what he would always say is, well, if you'll take out a big bag of salt, and you measure out a whole quart into my container for me, then I'm ready to tell you the difference. But if you're not ready to work for me a little bit, I'm not going to tell you nothing. You're coming to me as a resource. I want something in exchange for the resource. So we used to say, always, in this case, it's actually a pun. If you'll measure out a whole quart of salt for you, then I'll explain it to you. For me, I'll explain it to you. My time and the difference is obvious. If the kutach spills into salt, then the kutach is actually there. And if you use that salt to put it on meat, you put a piece of kutach on the meat. If kutach falls into a jar of vinegar, it's going to dissolve in the vinegar, and therefore it is not considered to be be'en. Now, in a fascinating situation where a pigeon, this pigeon was already shechted, it was kosher, and this pigeon falls into a whole giant container of kutach. Now, kutach is very salty, and this pigeon are pretty meaty. And this looked like a real disaster, and they were going to throw everything out. And what happened was they went to Rav Chinina Bereda Rava Pashronia, and he said, there's no problem. All you need to do is rinse off the kutach that comes out with the pigeon, and you can eat it. Now, that was pretty shocking. So Rava said, you got to be a real Talmud Chacham of the stature of Rav Chinina Berei de Rava Bar Pashronia to figure out why this pigeon is kosher. Man chochib l'mishreki ay gavna. You got to be really bright. If it wouldn't be Rav Chinina Berei de Rava Bar Pashronia, I don't know anybody else who would have been able to be mad to this. What is he saying? What he's saying is that even though all along we've had the Gavi rule that Meliach Hareyu Kiroteach, and that was said by Shmuel. And as you know, Kutach, I mean, one of the things about Kutach is that it's a very salty dip. It's a real salt dip. So wouldn't that, by definition, make this pigeon cooked in milk? How could he be matir it? Because he understood that the meaning of Shmuel's svara, Kiyoma Shmuel Meliach Hareyu Kiroteach, that was talking about a Meliach that is Eino Nechal Machmat Milcho. It's not referring to salting that is done for purposes of taste. It's referring to salting that is done for purposes of preservation or for purposes of drawing out the blood. That's a much deeper salt, which you wouldn't even be able to eat the thing until you wash the salt off. That's the type of melicha he was referring to when he said it's kiroteach. And that is called eino ne'echal machmat milcho. It cannot be eaten, it is so salty. So it would be wise for our Gavi to, in his Gavi rule previously, Meliach Hareyu Kiroteach, to add Meliach She'eino Ne'echal Machmat Milcho is Kiroteach. But this Kutach, obviously the whole point of the Kutach is that you're supposed to enjoy its salty taste. Nobody would call a potato chip Eino Ne'echal Machmat Milcho, and because of that, potato chips are not Kiroteach. So, now what we're talking about over here is a raw pigeon. Now, not everybody agrees that the issue over here is literally raw or roasted. There are many Rishonim who understand the sugya to be referring to hot and cold. We will take the Parshat approach of Rashi, means exactly what it says. Chai means it was a shechta chicken, but it was not a roasted chicken. But if the pigeon had already been roasted, that softened the surface of the pigeon. Then you're going to need to do kidei klipa. So you have to take off an actual layer. And as we explained earlier, the klipa is a layer that will hold together. You can hold it up. And whatever the thinnest layer is of that, you've got to take it off because the upper layer will absorb the milk of the kutach. But if it was meat bay peeling, if, however, because of the roasting, it has actual cracks in it, the surface, which go into the meat, then there's nothing to do because then it absorbs the kutach throughout and it's entirely filled with the tam of basar b'cholam. So if eat be pile kule osir. And another thing that would make it much more absorptive was if it was metubal. So in other words, if this were not only a roasted pigeon, but it would be a seasoned roasted pigeon, so then that makes it much more soft and more likely to absorb. And then even if let be pile, even if it doesn't have any cracks in it, it would still consider it to be osir and penetrated by the kutach. Okay, moving back to where we started from. So we were talking about melicha in the context of meat and blood, and we were talking about tzli in the context of meat and blood, and in between the previous discussion and this discussion, we talked about the duchka de sakina, but we only talked about duchka de sakina, the impact of duchka de sakina, which is the unrecognized by most unaware people, the unrecognized multiplication of force, which when it's applied to a large surface, and then in the end it all comes down to a very thin surface, tiny surface, is multiplied sometimes thousands upon thousands of times because of the difference in the surface between the entire knife, kli, and so on, and just the tiny piece that is coming into contact as a cutting surface, which therefore creates thousands of pounds of force and has immense physical impact. There's another thing about duchka de sakina that makes us rethink what we said before about blood. Because we talked before about the fact that the blood is going to essentially exude from its tzli as long as it's dripping down and it's not reabsorbed, right? So we didn't have a problem with that. But what happens if you cut a piece of meat? Oh my gosh, you cut a piece of meat that you just went through tzli. Okay, went through tzli, there's no more blood, nothing's coming out of it that's bloody. What happens if you put 1,000 pounds per inch force on it by cutting it with a knife? That's a whole different can of worms. And because of that, said Shmuel, Amrav Nachman Amar Shmuel, you've got a piece of bread. You cut a piece of meat over the piece of bread, which often happens. You have a big piece of meat, you want to make a sandwich, and you just cut off a little piece of it while it's still hot from the tzli. So you add it in a barbecue. What happens is that you squeeze blood out of the tzli that wasn't even noticeable before. And remember, dam ha'evarim sheparash, these are all amazing issues that we've just picked up over the past few weeks. And that's why I keep repeating them over and over, so that it should become, again, second nature. Dam ha'evarim is mutter. You're allowed to eat meat without taking out the blood at all. You don't need to salt it. You just put it, pop it into your mouth and eat it. But if you're going to cook it, then you got problems, because that blood is going to go out into the water and osir everything and then reabsorb by itself. So, as we said, the dam evarim sheparash is osir. Now, over here, we used tzli to remove it, but then we put it under pressure and we start squeezing blood out of it. And now the blood gets onto your sandwich. Now, this is very nogea South Africa. It's not really nogea in America, where they don't eat meat anymore. But in places where the blood is appreciated, you've got a serious problem if you cut the meat off of your braai over a piece of bread, and that bread turns all red and bloody because of the pressure of the knife, then, says Shmuel, that's called blood, and you're not allowed to eat that piece of bread. So if it was a kikar shechatach ala basar, we'll see more details of this coming up on Amud Beis, you're not allowed to eat it. Bahani mili da'asmik. That's only if it was red. Now, Rashi has a very strange pirush on this red. None of the other Rishonim agree. Rashi takes the word da'asmik as referring to the sugya that we had earlier. Remember the sugya we had earlier? Umtsa da'asmik. Umtsa da'asmik was a piece of meat that had been bruised in its lifetime, and now, as a piece of meat, has a deeply red area, which is the result of capillary bleeding while it was alive. So that is extra blood that's in that area, and it's not standard dame vari. So Rashi understands that the case of Shmuel is talking about the piece of meat was extra red. Nobody agrees with Rashi. And they take it kipshuta, that what we're talking about over here is only if the piece of bread turned red from the blood that you had pressed out by using the knife on the meat. Furthermore, hani mili de avrek, this is only if it cut through it, meaning that the whatever it was, we're assuming it's blood, went all the way through that loaf of bread from one side to the other. And it's hani mili de asbeche, it's only if what penetrated the bread was not liquidy like water, it was thick. And therefore, it seemed to actually be blood. But if it was just dripping, red dripping, kalishta, letlanbal, we don't worry about that. That's not considered to be blood. That's considered to be red-colored mual. Now, Shmuel, who held that it was usser, he would throw that to his dog so that it wouldn't be thrown out stam. But he would give it to Jock. You know, Jock would love to eat that bloody piece of bread. There we go. I'm sure you brought Jock along to Greece. I mean, how could you leave Jock alone? My gosh, I know. So anyway, the question is, did Shmuel have his own personal Jock? Because it says over here, he sent it to his dog. Did Shmuel own a dog? Well, there's another Gersa that says he would throw it to Kalba, a dog, not Kalbe, not his dog. Why would Shmuel have a dog, for heaven's sakes? No way. Okay. Ravuna, he would give it to whoever was serving him at the table. What? Manavshach, I don't understand. If he held it was kosher, so it would be kosher for him too, wouldn't it? And if it's not kosher, isn't it not kosher for the waiter? Understand, Ravuna. So how could he give it to the waiter? No, you don't understand. Ravuna held it was kosher. But Ravuna was a bit oversensitive about what kind of foods he would put in his mouth. So shiny Ravuna danina daite. So he was oversensitive, but he would certainly give it to his waiter who would enjoy it. Rava actually enjoyed eating it. And he said, are you guys kidding? This red is called the wine of the meat. It's absolutely the best. If you're going to have yourself a bride, then have yourself some wine of the meat with it. And kore le chamar basar, this is the best part. And he would go out for it. So Mimela, basically, he held that once you roast, anything else is not considered to be done. And in fact, that is the psak halacha. Once something is roasted, we don't consider things to be coming out of it, even under the pressure of duch desakina, to be blood. However, this does not apply to South Africa because of a very important caveat, which is that it has to be done enough that most normal humans would be ready to eat it. Since that t'nai is not fulfilled in a South African bride, and only a lion would be willing to eat the meat that comes off of the barbecue, it's not considered to be cooked. Okay, I mean, the shear of that is a shear which is called mechza. So it has to be cooked. A shlish usually is considered to be cooked in terms of Michael ben Drusoit, but when it comes to the issue of dan, we say it needs to be mechza roasted. Amr of Nachman on Shmuel. Another issue that relates to this question of dripping.
Sorry, Rabbi, practically that's medium rare? what
you,
would you want to define that today?
What you would call medium rare or what I would call medium rare? The last time you served me medium rare, I had to go to the dentist to try to figure out how I can save my teeth. I really don't know enough about meat to tell you. But getting back to our beidougi. So you remember the good old beidougi, which was the little container that was underneath the dripping in the shawarma shop. And the question over there was, is the dripping that goes into the beidougi, we were talking about a beidougi where there would be a piece of kaved on it, and we said, oh, that's a disaster, and you're going to have to wait until there's no blood before you're able to use the beidougi. Here, we're talking about a regular beidougi under a regular piece of meat, and Shmuel is reported to have said, Amar Reb Nachman Amar Shmuel, Ein menichin kli tachat basar, which we called before the beidougi. So you cannot put a container to catch the fat that is dripping down off of the vertical barbecue. You need to make sure that there's no longer red that's coming out. If red is coming out, then it's considered to still be bloody. But once that stops, then what's coming out is just shamnunis and just the basic tzir that's in the meat. That's called gravy. That's fine. Now, this actually is a problem, no? Because, I mean, Shmuel said that if you cut it, it would be considered to be blood. And how come over here it's not considered to be blood? Well, we already know the difference, because we spoke about the concept of Duchat HaSakina, but the Gemara hasn't gotten there yet. So on the surface, it certainly appears to be a problem. We're going to need to address it. But in any event, Shmuel here is Moda, that once what is dripping doesn't look red anymore, you can catch it in your beidougi, and you can eat it. As long as Yichle Kol Mar'eh Admimut Shebo. Well, how do you know? I mean, how can you tell that kol mare'a admimut? Is there a way to tell? Says Mar Zutram of Shmeder of Papa, yes. It's when it starts to smoke. Now, some learn that means that the meat actually smokes. Most understand that it means that the barbecue starts to smoke, because as long as blood is dripping on it, it doesn't smoke the way fat falling on it causes it to smoke. Because the blood actually just causes it to be kava for a moment, you know. So you get that type of smoking from something that isn't burning properly, but it doesn't have a smoke of the type of thickness that you have from fats. Now, once it's got that level of smoke and it's tale timrato, then obviously it's got fat that it's burning, not blood. Matkif Varavashi, how does that prove anything? All that that shows is that the lower layer of the meat, which is facing the coals, is dripping fat. But how do you know that the whole top part, which is further away from the heat, how do you know that that isn't filled with blood? And that if you leave the beidougi under it, so then blood is going to be coming down from the top. That doesn't prove anything. So v'dilma tato amata. So maybe the temperature has reached that level that it's cleared out all of the blood from the lower part of the meat, but ilah, the upper part of the meat, lo mata, hasn't even gotten to that stage yet. Elam Ravashi, you cannot rely on anything for a beidougi unless you know how to actually deal with a beidougi, and I'll tell you what to do. Let like takanta, there's nothing to do on the surface. What to do is mishta beitarte galalei milcha. You need to have two lumps of salt that you threw into it. That and no more, says Rashi, either. So you can't overdo the salting, which of course means in practical terms, this is useless information because of course we're not bekiyim to know what exactly, okay, as usual. But anyway, the halacha was meant to say that if you have the appropriate amount of salt that will not actually make the blood loose because of oversalting, but which will attract the blood, then All you need to do is to put that amount of salt in the beidugi, and that will draw the blood to the bottom where the salt is and has a different, obviously, because of the mixture, it's going to be heavier and it is not going to float up. And then whatever is on the surface is pure fat without any blood. And then if you pour that off, which is called to be mishafia, that was the word that we use for pouring off the top of wine that had like the little pieces of junk in it and so on. So this is mishafia. In this case, if you pour off the top and you're careful not to let the bottom mix into it, then you've got yourself pure fat and you could just throw out the rest, which is blood. I don't get it. Didn't we just see a glaring contradiction in what Shmuel said? Shmuel said that once the red is no longer there, so then you're allowed to take the fat. But Shmuel said, if you take a piece of meat, he just said that, take a piece of meat that was completely finished and it was on the barbecue, it's not ready to be eaten, you put it on a piece of bread and you cut. And he said, you're not allowed to eat the piece of bread because it's going to have blood on it. So how are you allowed to eat the fat from the beidugi? Aha. This is yet another application of the concept of ducha de sakina. And shine hatam, the agav ducha de sakina polit. The pressure itself makes the meat be polit. This is a completely different idea than the ducha de sakina being polit. What's in the sakina because of the intermolecular pressure that is causing stuff to come out of it. Here we're talking about the pressure on the meat that is going to force whatever remaining blood may be in there in the capillaries to come out. It is going to cause it to come out. And Shmuel held that that still had a din of blood, and because of that, it was us. Omer of Nachman, how about if you put dagim and ofot into the same perforated containers? We'll see, we'll talk about the perforations in a moment, but remember we always said that you need to use a perforated kli of some kind if you're going to be doing melicha, because we need the blood to be draining out to avoid its being reabsorbed by whatever had come out front. So, let's say you put fish and chicken in the same salt container, salting, I should say, container, and you remolcham ze imze. So what happens is they become usher. Now, it does not mean they become usher. It means it becomes usher, meaning the fish become usher, because the fish will absorb the dam that is coming from the oath. Well, I don't understand. What are we talking about? If it's a kli that is not perforated, so then it's not kosher at all. What do you mean, the fish? Even if you'd have a piece of chicken in it. Why do you say a chicken and fish? You could say chicken and chicken or anything, or even one piece of chicken. I mean, if you're not using a properly minuk of kli, then the dam is going to be reabsorbed. So then even ofot va'ofot would be usher, wouldn't they? So why are we talking about fish? And if we're talking about a perforated kli, which means that all of the dam is dripping straight out of the kli, so what's the problem of the fish? I thought we said that as long as things are exuding, they're not going to be absorbing. The kol zman de polit, as long as something is exuding the dam, it's eino bolia. So the fish is being polit. So why would the fish be bolea? Answers the Gemara, of course we're talking about a proper salting kli, and therefore it was menukav, and there's holes in it that allow the salt to drain. The reason that the fish are usher is because dagim have a completely different type of skin than the chicken has. Mishum de rafi karmayu, they essentially have a more like a thin membrane which passes for real skin. And because of that, kadme ufalte, for them to be able to lose all of the blood that's in them, they are polite very rapidly, and all of the blood comes out. Ofot, on the other hand, have a real kamid. They have a real thick and tight skin, and therefore it takes much longer for its blood to come out. And therefore, batar de naichi dagim, after the dagim, are no longer giving out anything, the chicken is still being polite. And because of that, the fish is no longer being polite, and therefore it will be bolea. And what it will be bolea will be the actual blood that's coming from the ofot. Now, the truth is that this is a very complex sugya that has a lot of practical implications, because the question would be, I mean, if this is the case, then that would mean that you wouldn't be able to do melicha unless you start both pieces off at the same time. Right? So you'd have to have like a stopwatch when you start the melicha, because if you put in one piece after you put in the other piece, so then that piece is going to be polite, and the other piece, what you would have, the first piece is going to stop being polite and will start being bolea, and therefore won't do you any good to have a perforated pot, because on its way out of the holes and the perforations, it's going to be absorbed by the newly absorptive meat that has finished being polite. So, I mean, this raises innumerable issues. And why wouldn't it matter how thick the piece of meat is? I mean, like, why are we only dealing with this issue when it came to the problem of the kaved, or the difference between chicken skin and fish skin? I mean, it sounds like it's a horrific problem, because you're telling me there's a specific time for the plita to be going on. And the din actually is that the shear of the zman for melicha is only really 18 minutes, according to the way we paskin. So once you've left it in the melicha, it supposedly has now finished being polite. So then that means if you leave it in for 25 minutes, it's going to start reabsorbing the dam. Or if you have two different pieces, when one is finished, the other one is going to continue to absorb, and so on. So how do you get that? So you're going to have to answer even other things, right? The truth is that the way we paskin this, and it's a machlokas exactly how far we go with this. However, for the next long time, it's machlokas haposkim, if that's the entire day, one day, or even a full 24 hours, so this is like an ona, 12 hours or 24 hours, the process of the dam coming out is not the full process of the plita. The plita is not only the actual dam, but the plita is what Rava called the wine of the meat. It continues to be polite all types of liquids that are coming from the meat that include, of course, whatever capillary dam there was. It includes anything that was liquids, such as lymph that was circulating in the meat, and so on and so forth. Melted fats, all of these issues are going to continue to be niflat over the course of the next day, as long as it remains in the melicha. So the melicha is not going to start reabsorbing unless it's left in there for a very long time. But the first 18 minutes, that's the time that it's pure blood. And afterwards, we essentially have tzir that's coming out. And the tzir coming out, l'chora, will also, this too is a machlokas rishonim, will prevent the dam from being absorbed. So Nanela, the only time that we have a real problem is when it comes to fish, because fish, even the tzir of the fish comes out very rapidly, and because of that, it is easily able to be bolea the dam that's coming out of the chicken and certainly out of a piece of meat. So that's the uniqueness of the case of the fish. Now, Rav Mori Barocho, but you can see, by the way, that there can be very, very specific cases where you're going to need a Moreh Hora'ah to define what the din is if someone left in the Malicha for a long time and what type of material it was and how to be machshiv it. These are not like, you know, the type of halachas that you look it up in your popular halacha book or you ask Rabbi Grok, what's the din, and you know, expect to get a serious answer. All right. So Rav Mori...
You should have to Miskav Ladach, Rabbi, we had that problem.
I remember that story. It was a painful story. So Rav Mori Barocha, he ended up salting meat, which he didn't realize, and one of the pieces of meat turned out to be trefa. So when they had taken in the meat immediately to do the malicha, and then when they checked afterwards, they were checking the lungs and so on, they saw that the meat from that animal was treif. So now he wanted to know whether he has a problem of the absorption of the dam and the tsir that are coming from the treifa meat into the kosher meat. So look, dam he knew, because that's no different than even than the all dam is not kosher. What's the difference if it's dam of a treifa or it's dam of the kosher? So he knew that dam was not a problem. As long as a piece of meat is being polite, then it's not going to absorb. But what he wasn't clear about was what's the status of the other juices in the meat, the things that Rava was referring to. And when he was talking about the juices of the meat, is that the same thing that because something is being polite dam, it won't absorb those things from another animal? Or if it's being polite its own tzir, it won't be bolea tzir or shamnunis from the non-kosher meat? Or is that not necessarily the case? So anyway, he comes to ask Rava if he's allowed to eat the kosher animal that had been salted together with the basar that was trefa. So Rava answered him, which was not a full answer, as we'll see. But Rava answered him from a pasuk. He said, the Braita darshins the words, this has been okay, the parsha of the shrotzim, the elu hatmeim lachem. So that's the shmoni shrotzim. We're talking about hatmeim. What exactly is the point of saying hatmeim? I mean, they're not hatmeim, they're tmeim, elu tmeim lachem. So we darshan that extra hey to be saying that this is the source of tmeim, meaning anything that's in these types of shrotzim are going to be usher as if they're the actual meat of the sheretz. And that's coming to add, le'asar tziran, oh, now this is interesting. The tzir, of course, is the juice that's coming out of the meat. That was exactly what it was that Rava was talking about. Rotvan, well, that would be if it's cooked in gravy. Kippa, we know what the kippa is. But basically, what's important to us here is tziran. So Rava is pointing out to him that the Braita identifies tzir as being a primary taste. So the same way that the juice is aser here in Hashratzim, the Hatmeim of Shratzim, it means that when you're talking about a non-kosher organism, in this case, not a sheretz, but the idea is it's treif for meat, so then it would mean that any tzir that was absorbed into the kosher meat would make it treif. And tzir, you were assuming that the tzir, since you have to deal with it on its own, is easily absorbed as compared to the dam, which is mishrak sharik and so on. So he's basically telling him, you're going to have to worry about that tzir. Now, but that wasn't what he was asking, was it? I mean, the question that he was asking wasn't whether tzir is usser. He was asking whether the plita of dam prevents the blia of the tzir. And so why is he answering him so obliquely? I mean, he should have told him straight out, look, we're talking about malicha. this is a malicha, which is by definition, if it's going to be the kosher malicha to take out the dam, then it also is going to be a malicha that is enonecha machmas milcho. You can't eat. I mean, that meat, if you've ever watched malicha, I mean, it is absolutely covered with that kosher salt. I mean, man, you can't get near that stuff. So unless it's all washed out. So then according to Shmuel, this is like a classic case of maliach areo kiroteach. That's what he should have said to him. He should have said to him, what's your question? Let me ask you something, buddy, is what he should have said. Suppose you had cooked the two together, the trefa with the kosher, would you have asked me a question? Would you have said, well, it's in the process of being polite, so who cares if I cooked it together? No. You never would have thought such a thing. Well, the same thing is true in the case of malicha. Since, according to Shmuel, malicha is considered to be, by definition, the equivalent of roasting it together. So that's the straight-out answer, like it was a perfect answer. That's what he should have said. Maliach areo kiroteach, kavush areo kemivushal. Why wouldn't that have been precisely what he was asking? Ah, because it's true. But Rava took for granted that he understood that. Rava wanted to tell him the cherry on top of the pudding. In other words, look, before we deal with the obvious issues, okay, what you're going to talk to me about the question of whether tzir is considered to be the equivalent of dam in the plita, obviously not. If you want to talk to me about whether a polate is doche the tzir, obviously not, because maliach areo kiroteach. I know that you're a Talmud Chacham, but maybe ultimately you could question, is just tzir, which is the thing that we're talking about over here, is that usher? So I'm telling you, yeah. When you get to the bottom question, you know what your question boils down to? Is tzir kosher? Well, the pasuk says it's not kosher. Thank you. Next, please. And that's basically what he was trying to say. So if he would have just told him Shmuel, so then I could still come back and say, okay, Shmuel is talking about something that is not kosher. So he's talking about blood. Blood, of course, but I'm asking about the tzir. Is the juice, is that not kosher? Come mashmalan. Therefore, he goes all the way to the top and says, look, what it really depends on is that one issue. Is tzir kosher? No. That's your answer. Okay, Rabosai, my goodness gracious. We've done some serious elements over here, adding the more and more details about, first of all, what is the shear of malicha, which we spoke about, and what is the shear of plita of other things like tzir and rotev that would also make it possible to leave things together for a certain amount of time. We learned a new concept, a new element of duchka, the sakina, which we hadn't spoken about before, and that's the relationship of the duchka, the sakina, not to the iser, which is within the sakin or on the surface of the sakin, but the actual issue of pressure on something that contains dam, which would itself not have been usur, but now because of super pressure might become usur. We've talked about the ability to separate the dam from the shamnunis when it comes to a beidugi, and the question of the iser of mohal, that is yotze from basar, if it has the thickness of dam and it has the color of dam, whether it's considered to be usur even after you did the proper shear of broiling it. And we ended up saying, like Rava Lahalacha, that it's not usur. And we talked more about the specific cases of not barnan, where the knot is able to be actually under pressure or under heat. And remember, heat and pressure act together here in these cases. So these are all very, very physical concepts that are nogea, actual situations that come up when you have to deal on a commercial level and you're dealing with factories and you have to analyze the pressure that's involved in certain cookers and you're analyzing the heat that's involved. These are very detailed nakudas, such that the actual career of a kashrus authority is a very, very complex, demanding an immense amount of industrial actual expertise. And because of that, you have these people that are truly experts in the field, and they are essentially engineers, food processing engineering, because these are real physical concepts. Dulche de Sakina can be translated into literal quantitative amounts, in which we include that to be the amount of pressure per inch that is considered to be duchit sakina. The question of heat that causes absorption is actually quantitative, with big machlokas and that are nogea even in parts of a single degree, which will make a difference if something is kosher or not, or whether something is considered to be boiled or not, like abikashas of yayin, and the interrelationship of pasteurization and rapid heating and rapid cooling to the idea of bliyah. I mean, you can't imagine the thousands upon thousands of detailed questions that come up, because these are real, serious, physical things. They're not like just wishy-washy kinds of ideas. And because of that, I've been repeating them over and over again so that we can understand the basic concepts. And Bezrat Hashem, I thought I'd have time today, but Bezrat Hashem will go over them rapidly, because there's some serious machlokas in here between the Sfaradim and Ashkenazim about the issues of Nat Bar Nat, where, and again, as I mentioned at the beginning, not by not is only relevant where the first time was a tam. If the first time was already pagum, and that's the question which, of course, also comes up in food technology, of what is considered to be a tam pagum, and therefore mutter, is it mutter lechatchila, is it mutter only b'diavad, is the processing of a factory considered to be a lechatchila, is it bitulis or lechatchila, and so on and so forth. Good heavens, every last piece is a problem. So there's big differences between the Sephardim and Ashkenazim of Nat Bar Nat, which I'll discuss, Bezrat Hashem, it's already late. I'll try to remind me, if you can, to start off tomorrow with that discussion so we don't leave, this was the end of our Nat Bar Nat here, we don't leave our Nat Bar Nat page without getting a little bit nutty and figuring out the various dinim.